I started trading tapes a few years later. So when I was 12 years old, I started trading tapes, and my friends, I was asking them to send me things, and, you know, I would occasionally buy tapes, $10, $15 a pop. I did the HTML for John McAdam in exchange for tapes, and John had a very extensive collection. So I got a lot of stuff from him.
From Bombay to Santa Fe, from Milan to Yucatan, it's the Stick to Wrestling Podcast. Congratulations, if you know what song that is all from. My name is John McAdam. This is Stick to Wrestling, where if you give us 60 minutes, perhaps indeed, we'll give you a wicked good and raw bone podcast. Join our Facebook group. It's a lot of cool guys. We talk wrestling, we talk baseball, basketball, music, the whole thing. It's free to join. Just if you enjoy the podcast, you will enjoy the group. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, just search John McAdam and follow the guy with the Stick to Wrestling logo as his avatar. I don't just stick to wrestling. As a matter of fact, I did a college football podcast with former and future guest Sonny Martinez, and I've gotten a lot of followers from that. So thank you if you're listening for that, or you know, if you're following me on Twitter for that. You'll get a little college football now, probably a lot more in September. And most importantly, I want to thank everyone. We're continuing our deep dive into 1984 World Wrestling Federation and their national expansion. I'm going to be honest, when we decided to do this, well, we started recording those about 3 years ago. It was supposed to be a standalone podcast, and that just didn't happen. And I was worried that this was going to be, just really specific. And it is, but it's been received really well, so I want to thank everyone for that. I've said this before more than once. 40 years later, I continue to marvel at what Vince McMahon and the WWF did. They had an extremely popular and successful promotion, a profitable business. And they were like, yeah, let's just change everything. Let's just completely change what the WWF is. It's like, you know, going to a restaurant that you can't get a table at 9 o'clock on a Tuesday night. And the owner just says, yeah, let's change everything. And it worked. So congratulations to Vince. And once again, thank you for everyone. Thank you to everyone for listening. And we'll get rolling on this right now. Los Angeles on Saturday, March the 10th, 1984, WWF in a huge market. Tony Garea defeats Roddy Piper by forfeit. Wow, what's going on here, Steve? I have no idea. If Piper was a no-show, then they'd obviously have a substitute, but it doesn't say what happened here. I can only imagine that Piper just refused to wrestle Tony, you know, did an angle where he just wouldn't wrestle Tony Garea because he was mad about what happened on the pit.
I think that they actually did the old school angle, and this goes back to an angle that Freddie Blassie used to do in WWF and also on the West Coast, where he would show up with his arm in a sling and said, you know, I can't wrestle. And then Garea turns his back on him, and all of a sudden he's like getting belted by in the back of the head with his cast, you know, and Piper laid him out. I believe that was what was in the Observer wrap up of it. So
I'm glad you had that, because it was left to my imagination. Obviously I was wrong. Tito Santana successfully defends the Intercontinental Championship against Mr. Fuji. Jay York beats Billy Anderson, once again saving some trans cost. I think that makes sense. Big John Studd defeats Tony Rocco. Wow, talk about a height difference there.
yeah, tough Tony Rocco wrestled for pretty much every promotion during a long career.
Yeah, not an exceptionally tall guy, to say the least. John Tolos defeats Jack Armstrong. Dr. D. David Schultz over Mickey Doyle. You know, more L.A.-based guys, including this one. Al Madrill and Tony Atlas defeat the Masked Superstar and Sergeant Slaughter. That's kind of an odd pairing.
Yeah, it looks like he was just filling in for Rocky Johnson. I don't know if he was a no-show or had a sick day or something, but Al Madrill was well-known going back to the early 80s, late 70s in that in the old LA-based promotion. So he got a kind of a high spot on the card here.
Okay, we got Paul Orndorff against another local guy, defeats Jerry Monty, and WWF champion Hulk Hogan fights the Iron Sheik to a double disqualification. With the pot, no, I'm coming out and calling this a two-match card. Atlas and either Madrill or Rocky Johnson versus Superstar and Slaughter. Hogan against the Sheik. The rest of this, I mean, not only do the matches not look good, they don't sound competitive.
Yeah, I think from the Observer, I think they only drew around 7,000 or so. So,
oh wow,
they were still kind of like finding their footing here, and I think they had some missteps along the way with some of the, you know, no shows and things. But it, as time would prove on, they're building an audience with all their TV programming and the syndicated shows, and over time, especially with Hogan being forefront and center. The promotion would do better and draw better in that market too.
I can see that. Same night in New Haven, Connecticut, we have Andre the Giant, the main event, winning an 18-man battle royal. Nothing else on the show is worth mentioning. Then we get to All-Star Wrestling on Sunday the 11th. We have Rocky Johnson and Tony Atlas defeating Johnny Ringo and Rene Goulet. Iron Sheik defeats Steve Lombardi. The Blair and Gurria team defeat Iron Mike Sharp and Ron Shaw. Ivan Putski beats Israel Mattia. Sergeant Slaughter beats Butcher Vershawn. Greg Valentine beats Steve Williams. And Chief J Strongbow beats Tony Russo. Steve, let me go back and look at this. I had Tony Rocco and Tony Russo confused. Tony Russo's the short one.
That's right. Yeah, he's stubby legs. Yeah.
Okay. So now let's talk a little bit about WWF TV in general. I mean, talk about both WWF Championship Wrestling and All-Star Wrestling from this week, with the exception of the interviews. If you missed these shows, you missed nothing. The WWF always had slow-moving television compared to the other promotions, but, I mean, this weekend they were ridiculous.
I think in this time frame, you, as a fan, if you're really a fan, you have to watch the Championship Wrestling show, the main show. The other shows were like All-Star Wrestling. You're just going to see maybe new matches, but nothing worthwhile, no angles. And then the other shows like the All-Americans and whatever else show they had on the air at this time, it was just more of a recap. So you're not missing anything that you wouldn't see elsewhere.
No, you're not. And, like, you know, if you're a hardcore fan like Steve and I were, of course you're watching All-Star Wrestling, but it was very rarely was it any good. All right, let's go to the New Jersey Meadowlands. But first, here's what happened, and I remember this. They're all of a sudden on WLVI-TV in Boston, Channel 56, they had a promo for the New Jersey Meadowlands. Let's hear that promo right now.
For you, the great fans of the greater New York metropolitan area, it is going to be World Wrestling Federation action, the Meadowlands Arena, East Rutherford, New Jersey, Sunday, March the 11th, 8:30 p.m. start, 20-man battle royal, over-the-top rope, the only way a man can be eliminated, $15,000 to go to the winner. Also, to be part of that card, in addition to the battle royal, it's going to be a world title defense for the very popular champion out of Venice Beach, California. My guest at this time, the incredible Hulk Hogan, Dr. David Schultz, the man you're going to have to contend with, the challenger, and obviously Roddy Piper will be in his corner.
You know, it's amazing. Ever since January the 23rd, when the Hulkster became the king of the mountain, when I went to the top of the ladder, you know, the whole picture's changed around the WWF. It seems like everybody's back on their feet. All my people, they're out posing in the parking lot. They're training every day in the gym. They're training at home. They're training at the job. They're training in the bedroom. They're training all over the place. And the thing is, Hulkamania's running wild. There's such a sight going now. I don't think there's any way the Hulkster will ever come off the top. But the thing is, Mean Gene, this man, Dr. D, David Schultz, I heard him popping off, talking about the people that I've got a love affair with, the great Americans of the United States. He's knocking them daddy, trying to put them down. He's making this thing a personal issue, Mean Gene. And when I get my hands on this man, I don't know how far. I don't know if I can even control myself.
Well, Hulk Hogan, Dr. David Schultz, a man that has certainly proven himself, and obviously the powers to be, considering
you know,
him a
wait a minute, Mean Gene. I didn't mean to interrupt. I know he's proven himself time and time again. I did just some checking up on the man. He is a rough and tough individual. But one thing, tough times don't last forever, but tough people do. And I feel right now, with all the people behind me in Hulkamania running wild, I'm the toughest there is.
Middleland Sunday, March the 11th, World Wrestling Federation action.
Okay, I was going to make a joke. This show drew 21,777 fans on a Sunday night. I was going to make a joke like, oh, wow, no wonder they aired it once in Boston. No wonder they got such a great attendance. Everyone drove down. But this had to be a mistake in placement because you don't want to let the Boston fans know that, oh, yeah, next Saturday, Hogan's defending against Dr. D. David Schultz in Boston. But this Sunday, he's also doing the same thing.
Had you ever seen a mistake like that made before where they had like a different market interview showing up in Boston?
I've heard about it happening before. WCW in the late 80s, early 90s was famous for it. But WWE, this is the only one I think I actually saw.
Yeah, I didn't ever recall seeing anything like this. So it just shows you how good they were as far as tying the promos in and bicycling the tapes, as they used to say, and getting the right tape to the right place.
Yeah, I think things were getting a little more chaotic at WWF headquarters at this point. You know, Hulk Hogan used to talk about how he would lift every single day, training every day, you know, eating your vitamins, hitting the rack, whatever. And as a kid, I'm like, yeah, you can't lift every day. That's not how it works. I never added two and two together that, yeah, steroids help you recover and, yeah, he can train, he can lift every day if he wants to.
Yeah, he, the fact that he's still around now and, still looks reasonably okay, I know he's had the numerous back surgeries and, I don't know, what his true health is, but I mean, just the fact that he's still living where, I guess the first six opponents he had at WrestleMania are all gone now, it's just, it's an amazing tribute to his ability to survive.
Meadowlands, big show, obviously. Invader number 2 defeats Israel Mattia. Rocky Johnson defeats Iron Mike Sharp. Esty Jones defeats Rene Goulet. Mass Superstar defeats Salvatore Bellomo. Tiger Chung Lee defeats Jose Luis Rivera. Wow, see you later to that winning streak. Ivan Putski defeats Samoan Afa by DQ. Mr. Fuji and Tony Garea go to a 15-minute time limit draw. Steve, I'm sure you'll understand this. If that is not the most pure and beautiful result known to man, two lower card guys, multiple time tag team champions, have been around forever, and they just go out there and do a 15-minute Broadway.
It must have been. I wonder if they. It sounds. I mean, in the 70s, I know they worked together in the Shire's promotion in San Francisco, and they.
Oh, that's right.
They were very. Good in that era, but by now these guys were on fumes. So I don't think this was a match where people were getting their pretzels and their cokes.
The main event is Hulk Hogan pins Dr. D. David Schultz, and then Andre the Giant wins a 17-man battle royal. This show has literally nothing except for the Hogan title match and the Battle Royal. If you like Battle Royals, which they made a big deal out of, I mean, 21,777 on a Sunday night in the middle of the winter. That's crazy.
Yeah, it just, I mean, the WWF was really pushing all the right buttons. I mean, they had Hulk Hogan on top, who was becoming kind of a mainstream celebrity. You had all the old WWF, standby stars like Andre and Putski were on the card, and pretty much the whole roster is there. Even Lou Albano participated in the Battle Royal, it looks like. So, there was nothing they couldn't do. I mean, they were just printing money at this point, New York was always their key market, so business there only continued to improve as they made the expansion to the rest of the country.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, obviously the fans are coming out to see this new Hulk Hogan guy, and it's working out so far. And frankly, that formula kept working. The fans kept coming out to see mediocre shows with Hulk Hogan on top. The same night in Bennington, Vermont, at the Mount Anthony Union High School, they had a match. They had a show out there with Sergeant Slaughter versus the Iron Sheik and Tito Santana versus Paul Orndorff, sharing a little bit of local knowledge. If you are not, if you are in Vermont but not in Burlington, you are in the middle of nowhere, and it's not like Burlington's Tokyo anyway. Yet Tito Santana, Sergeant Slaughter, the Iron Sheik, Paul Orndorff are coming to your town. Not to belabor this point, but that's one was one of the most one of the beautiful things about wrestling in the 70s and 80s.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's a good point, John. And these are pretty much the two best matches you could see on a WWF show at this time frame is those two matches. And here you are at a high school gym, getting not only to enjoy the matches, but it's probably for a fundraiser too, which is a good thing.
It very much, I believe this was a fundraiser. And yeah, so most of the crew is looking, you know, is at an arena where if you step outside, you can see the Manhattan skyline. And these guys are in Bennington, Vermont, wherever that is. All right. Now, for once again, for review purposes only, let's hear the promos that aired on WVLI Channel 56 in Boston for that night's Boston wrestling show at the Garden.
Well, a week from tonight, here in Boston at the Boston Garden, Sergeant Slaughter will be meeting Mr. Fuji in a grudge match. It is going to be quite a St. Patrick's Day for the Sergeant, because Sergeant Slaughter, in person, 1:30 p.m., at the Out of Town News Harvard Square here in Boston, will be signing copies of the brand-new World Wrestling Federation magazine, While the Supply Lasts. Some very, very interesting reading. You can pick up your copy next Saturday afternoon. Sergeant Slaughter, come on in. Going to be a busy day for you, St. Paddy's Day in this great city.
That's right. Doesn't matter if you're Irish, what color you are, if you're an American, I want to see you down there. 1:30 at the Harvard Square. Then we're going to mosey on down to the combat zone, the Boston Garden, and you and me, Mr. Fuji. They call it a grudge match. I think it goes back a long ways. World War II. I know a lot of men out there, a lot of women. There's a lot of them that aren't here anymore. God rest their souls, that fought in that war, have fought in other wars, and no stinking Jap like you is going to come out here and downgrade the United States of America as long as I'm alive. As long as I'm an American. Mr. Fuji, you said some nasty things out here, and all you gotta do is pay for it. If you're gonna bring an American flag to the Boston Gardens, don't bring it unless you believe in it.
Those are the words of Sergeant Slaughter, his grudge match with Mr. Fuji. And of course, some of the rhetoric that has been exchanged between these two men will be leading up to that head-on collision next Saturday night. Tickets available in advance. Don't miss it.
All right, I guess I blew that one. That aired the week before. Sorry about that. But a couple of things to go over. Steve, number one, I am still as delighted like a child over the tale of Colonel Fuji that we heard about 2 weeks ago.
Oh yeah, the Colonel Fuji interview, which I had never heard before until then. It was just unbelievably over the top interview from Mr. Fuji, and it really sure sold a few tickets to this feud. And Slaughter here is just a great interview, and he's really at the height of his popularity here.
He really is. Now, I saw a feature in the Boston Globe later that week. I believe it was on Tuesday. Of Sergeant Slaughter's visit to Out of Town News in Harvard Square. The place was not remotely prepared for the turnout that came out for Sergeant Slaughter. They were overwhelmed. They immediately sold out of magazines, which I recall them reading, you know, they had a whole bunch. They just were not ready for the crowd that descended upon Harvard Square on that day.
Yeah, I mean, you got to remember, for any TV celebrity showing up at an event like this, I mean, it's so rare to be able to meet somebody you like on TV from whatever program it might be. But yeah, I mean, it doesn't surprise me that he drew a huge crowd. And you and I are such hardcore wrestling geeks and magazine geeks. I, of course, would have preferred my issue be not signed, so it would stay in mint condition.
I would have wanted Sergeant Slaughter's autograph. I wouldn't have cared. So one like little kind of not a personal note, but an off wrestling note. When we first moved up to the Boston area, and I would watch the news. Every single night I watched, there would be a report on the 11 o'clock news on who got stabbed that night in the combat zone in Boston. And I'm pretty sure the combat zone was gone by this point in 1984.
Wow. Well, it sounded good in the promo, though. It sounds like, you know, this is the place to be. And if you're on your way to the Boston Garden, you know, be in the combat zone. So Slaughter made it seem like a really cool place to be.
No. It's where they hid all the bad. They came up with this idea. Let's have all of the bad stuff in one little place in Boston. And it did not work out. Like I said, I think by this point, it was all long gone. But anyway, more promos for the Boston Garden coming up. Let's check them out. Once again, they are for review purposes only.
Oh, happy St. Patrick's Day. Tonight, the Boston Garden. The World Wrestling Federation at its very, very finest. Sergeant Slaughter, by the way, at this very moment on his way to the out-of-town news, Harvard Square, here in Boston. The world's heavyweight champion, the incredible Hulk Hogan, title defense for him tonight in the Garden. The challenger, Dr. David Schultz, Hulk Hogan. Hulk, come on in. Happy St. Patrick's Day to you.
You know, I appreciate that, Mean Gene, but that's not the point. You know, I've been out in L.A. all week long, man. I was trying to get it together, keep my mind on business, man, trying to train and get the psych. But I couldn't do it. My mind was in Boston. I had to get back to where my people were, where the intensity was. And that's just what I did. I took the first 747, flew into Boston, cut me a private training quarter, and I've been hanging and banging for 48 hours. And tonight is the night. Dr. D, I'm in Boston right now. I'm ready for you. And the thing is, I've been walking the streets. Everywhere I go, Hulkamania's running wild. Everywhere I go, the people are behind me. And Dr. D, I don't know what you're going to do tonight when Hulkamania runs wild on you.
All right, Hulk, let's see that T-shirt. Let's see it.
Wait a minute. This T-shirt, Hulkamania, there will be thousands of them. Thousands upon thousands. And Dr. D, you're going to feel like an alien, a man from Mars. You are not even going to know what's going on because they're all on my side, Mean Gene. It's the world's title. There's no stopping me now. And I am wired for sound, Dr. D.
All right, the words of the heavyweight champion of the world, the incredible Hulk Hogan, big title defense for him tonight. Paul Orndorff, Mr. Wonderful. Tony Garea, the ring veteran tonight at the Boston Garden.
Mean Gene, when? I have been to the Boston Garden several times. When am I going to get some competition?
Well, Tony Garea will be enough.
I'm tired of it. He's a good wrestler. There's no doubt about it. I'm not going to take that from him, but I'm the best there is to offer. I am about this much better than Tony Garea. And you know, I got a lot of fans out there. As I look out there, they got my name, Paul Orndorff, the greatest in the world, Mr. Wonderful.
Where's that at?
Boston Garden. St. Patrick's Day. Everybody's going to be there to see me, especially all the ladies. You know, after it's all over and done with, I might pick me one of those ladies out and take her out somewhere. Right? But not the fat ones. I don't like fat women.
Tampa, Florida, Paul Orndorff. Big one for him tonight. Tony Garea, I hope he is not underestimating the man at all. Andre the Giant, what a card. Let me ask you a question. Grenoble, France. Frenchmen, do they celebrate St. Patrick's Day in your country?
Oh, yes. We do that too over there.
Do they drink the green beer?
Yes, and they're going to do it in Boston because my superstar claim, the last time I was in Boston was when I was in the hospital because when my leg was broke. And he claimed he was going to send me back to the hospital. And my superstar took a big guy to get sent me in the hospital. I know you are a good wrestler. But believe me, I don't come in back in Boston to go back in the hospital. I come in back in Boston to win my match and to celebrate the St. Patrick's Day, too. Are you going to be there, too?
Are you kidding? I am leaving right from here. I'm going to get down there. There are plenty of good seats available. Andre the Giant, can I ask you a favor?
Yes.
I have been admiring that very, very attractive suit coat of yours. Is there any chance that you would allow me to try that on?
Sure.
Well, how about this, ladies and gentlemen, if I may? I have prevailed upon the big man, Andre the Giant. Well, thank you. Oh. My word, it looks like a top coat for crying. I can't believe this, Andre. This, you've got to have a lot of material wrapped up in that. I thank you very much. You can take her back if you want. Unbelievable. Unbelievable indeed. Andre, the Boston Garden, a facility that has so much wrestling tradition, and you have been a big, big part of it so for very, very many years.
I think the wrestling the garden, the Boston Garden, not going to be big enough to take all those people in there, because West Superstar, now I got the green light from the Athletic Commission. It's okay to take out the mask off.
Will you be doing that tonight if that opportunity should prevail?
Believe me, if I got a chance to do it, that's what I'm going to do.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, this man, plus the cream of the crop in the World Wrestling Federation, Andre the Giant, the incredible Hulk Hogan, with a world title defense against Dr. David Schultz, the top names in all of professional wrestling to be part of the big one. As I said before, plenty of good seats are available. That grudge match between Sergeant and Slaughter and Mr. Fuji, this man, of course, the mass superstar, you won't want to miss it. It's going to be some kind of a night indeed.
So Hulk Hogan, it was in Boston right now. I guess they moved the location of the set to Boston just for that day.
Well, yeah. it gave the fans at home a feeling like, wow, he came all the way here just to do this interview. So
yes, everyone did, because Andre was in Boston right now, too. Obviously, you couldn't see it. But Gene Okerlund wearing Andre the Giant's sports jacket was hilarious. I mean, Okerlund just got lost in the thing, and it really did look like not just a top coat, but a really long top coat. It was funny.
I think I remember seeing them do that in the AWA, he just looked like a little kid wearing a man suit or something. It was funny.
He really did, which is, you know, goes to show how huge Andre the Giant was. All right, Championship Wrestling from Saturday, March 17th, 1984. We have the Samoans. They're still around, going over SD Jones and Steve Lombardi. Paul Orndorff defeats Angelo Gomez. And then we have Bob Backlund doing an amateur wrestling exhibition with two children. Couple of things. Number one, what a waste of TV time. I guess the WWF did that a lot back in the day, but still, this is exceptional. You know, my theory has always been, if you have a 60-minute show, you need to utilize every minute of that getting your characters over. But number two, there's a theory out there, Steve, that the WWF was trying to sabotage Bob Backlund with stuff like this. And to this day, I still don't believe it. Backlund was still main eventing major arenas. Why would they want to sabotage the guy? It makes no sense.
Yeah, I don't think it was a sabotage. I think it was more just like an old school type thing. I mean, Eddie Graham in Florida, who was very close with Vince, the old elder Vince, who was almost passing away here by this time frame. They did a lot of amateur wrestling and stuff with their performers in the Florida promotion, with like the boys and girls clubs and things like that. So this is like a throwback. This is like an old school thing to show that. This, they didn't call him a legend or anything, but, you know, Bob Backlund had been champion for 6 years. So putting him in that light as someone who's giving back to the kids, I can see why they did it, as far as just trying to portray their athletes as sportsmen and people who are people of goodwill and, you know, doing good things.
I can see that. I just remember watching this as an 18-year-old and say, you get this crap off my television. For real.
How dare you, John? It's an abomination.
It's not what I tuned in to see. All right, the Invaders are still around. They defeat Charlie Fulton and Tony Russo. And next, Andre the Giant appears on Piper's Pit. We don't even have to wish for it, kids. We have it. Once again, this is for review purposes only.
Piper's Pit, we'd like to flatly state that the views of Mr. Piper are those of Mr. Piper alone. Not necessarily those of us here on Championship Wrestling or this station, or for that matter, his guests. With that in mind, ladies and gentlemen, we anxiously await now
Okay, here we go.
Let's take you to Piper's.
I'm not that well acquainted with you. First of all, Andre, here we have this week on Piper's Pit, of course, Andre the Giant, supposedly the biggest man in the world ever. It's a pleasure to have you. Where are you from, Andre? I'm sorry, do you speak English? Where do you come from?
None of your business.
If the questions are too hard for you, I will try to bring them down a little so you can understand. I understand big body, little tiny weeny brain. I can understand that. That's very simple. Let's get right down to facts. Is it not true that John Studd himself took the largest man like yourself, supposedly in the world, and picked him up and slammed him? Is it not true that John Studd slammed you?
Never.
Are you telling me that John Studd never slammed you? You trying to tell me at 540 pounds, whatever you are, that you cannot be slammed?
Are you understanding English or no? I told you that one time.
At 520 pounds, if I given 5 minutes, I could slam you myself. I don't care. You're saying John Studd could at 520.
I like how Vince McMahon comes out and he says, "We would like to flatly state that the views expressed on Piper's Pit flatly." Wow.
And I thought it was funny when Piper said to Andre, like, if I'm given 5 minutes, I can slam you. And I always thought, like, well, what's he going to do with the 5 minutes? Like, rent a U-Haul or a kind of a cherry picker, somebody to pick him up with?
as you all may have guessed, at that moment, Andre the Giant had enough of Roddy Piper, and he grabs him by his shirt collar and starts shaking him around. And then when Andre leaves the set, Piper takes off his shirt and says, "Come on, let's go, let's fight."
Yeah, that the way that ended with Piper going ballistic verbally on Andre, I'm pretty sure that he used that. I think it was on the Piper Coliseum video. It just he used that in a key spot and then followed up with a match. And it was definitely a very popular episode of Piper's Pit.
Yeah, it was a really good one. And Piper's Pit was absolutely the highlight of this show. It was on, I believe, after the third match. If not, it was after the second match. And you'd hear like a little bit of Yes's Owner of a Lonely Heart. Dun, 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 and you'd be like, yes, it's Piper's Pit time.
Oh, yeah. It was really the definitely the highlight of each week's show, other than the localized interviews. And you didn't know until it happened. You really didn't know who the guest was going to be. So that also kept you kind of guessing as far as what was going to happen this week.
That's another good point. You know, you're like, okay, who's the guest going to be? That was like a big part of my week as a wrestling fan. Who's going to be on Piper's Pit this week?
Yeah, those were good days. And it was interesting to see like how over time, as we continue with the national promotion, how our national expansion, how the pit evolves, and it gets to be much different with Bob Orton involved and the different guests. And of course, when Piper turns face, that changes everything too.
Definitely. We'll talk more about how Piper's Pit evolved as the pod. Well, you know what? We'll talk a little bit about it now. Piper's Pit was fantastic week after week. At this time, we are coming close to the point where we're getting the Cyndi Lauper angle, which was incredible. But Steve, I thought by the end of 1984, Piper's Pit really fell off. And by the middle of 1985, it was bad.
I think it was bad, and the point, like, where he had people like Johnny V and the Dream Team hosting were on there, and they had on like Mrs. Willie McCovey and a couple of other people. I mean, it was like a space in the flea market. You could rent it out to anybody who wanted to host it, and I always had a fondness for Piper's Pit.
Oh, I mean, Roddy Piper's one of my all-time favorites. It just seemed like by the end of Piper's Pit's run, he felt kind of burned out from it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. It was different near the end. As he retired, and the WWF had really kind of turned the page or turned the corner. It went from being like this hot, cool sports entertainment to being more like, okay, it's the WWF. Okay, we know what to expect. It was kind of paid by the numbers by the time he came back in 89, and they didn't bring the Pit back. And it was just like a completely different promotion at that point.
No, definitely. Like I said, I think it's one of those things where it's hard for Piper to keep sharp, especially if they're doing three pits per taping. But anyway, the rest of Championship Wrestling is Greg Valentine defeats Tony Garea. And then we have a couple of weird throwaway matches. Butcher Rashawn defeats Frank Ruiz, who I don't remember, and Salvatore Bellomo defeats Ron Shaw.
Yeah, very rare to see those kind of matches on there. I'm not sure how they made the cut.
All right. Now let's go to one final audio clip for this week. Once again, this is for review purposes only.
Happy St. Patrick's Day to you, the great fans of the greater Boston area. Tonight at the Garden, the World Wrestling Federation at its very, very finest. Sergeant Slaughter to meet Mr. Fuji in what they're labeling as a grudge match. Andre the Giant assigned the task of going against the Masked Superstar. And this man right here, come on in, Dr. David Schultz, will be challenging the Incredible Hulk Hogan tonight for the world's title. I'm very curious, Dr. D, what kind of a champion would you make, in your opinion?
Well, that's none of your business in the first place. If it was, I would tell you. And I don't think you're writing no book, so if you are, you can leave that chapter out. Now, Hulk Hogan, you might have been in California, you might have been out lifting weights, and you might have been on the beach. I don't know what you've been doing, but you've been up to something that ain't right. I'll guarantee you that. Well, I'll tell you what the doctor's been doing. I've been walking the streets of Boston, baby. I've been going to every bar and every honky-tonk, and I've been looking for a fight. I've been looking for somebody that wanted to fight the doctor, and I couldn't find nobody that could stand up to me. Evidently, they got a lot of your blood running through their body because there's been a lot of mixing and matching amongst the families.
Please,
now,
please.
When I seen I couldn't find a fight, I decided to look for a woman. And the doctor ain't found no woman either. He ain't found no woman. He found some ladies and some girls. So that shows what Boston's got to offer. So you come on down to Boston, boy. St. Patrick's Day, everybody's going to be out, and it's going to be a big party, and it ain't going to be no tea party. I'm going to beat you so bad. I'm going to hit you so hard and fast, you're going to say, y'all quit. And after I get through with you, I'm going back there to honky-tonking bar.
I don't know if I have the heart to tell Dr. D that there are no honky-tonks in Boston. There weren't in 1984 either.
So you're watching this on TV live, and you're thinking to yourself, well, I'll be at the show in 6 or 7 hours, and maybe we should save that for next week.
Yeah, we'll definitely do that next week. I was at the show. I can tell you guys about it. Before we say goodbye, Wrestling from the Chase aired on Saturday the 17th of 1984. Tito Santana defeated Rene Goulet. Dr. D. David Schultz defeats Brian Madden. Adrian Adonis and Dick Murdoch defeat Lou Chaney and Terry Daniels. And Rocky Johnson and Tony Atlas defeat Israel Mattia and Bob Bradley. Two quick points I want to make about this show. Steve, Adrian Adonis and Dick Murdoch have yet to appear on Championship Wrestling or All-Star Wrestling. I'm wondering what's up with this.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, as time would move on, and they kind of streamline the process of their shows. You know, usually on Superstars, the guys would debut or championship wrestling. This time, the kind of like Adonis and Murdoch are coming in through the back door, and they're on other programs before they're even on the main show. But they will become a major factor on the show very soon.
Yeah, I mean, they would be a major factor. Like I said, I think it's, you know, just another reflection of, you know, they're not terribly organized at this point in time. Terry Daniels is out doing jobs on TV. I'm sure Lou Chaney got pinned, or I think he got pinned. But we'll talk more about Terry Daniels as time goes on. But, you know, he had kind of a nice spot in the, as Sergeant Slaughter's under, I don't know, his protege, that's the word I'm looking for, but they never seemed to max that out. It was almost like a wasted opportunity.
Well, there is an angle coming up soon that we'll be reviewing where he's at his post with the flag, and I think Iron Sheik gives him a low blow, and he doesn't drop the flag, and it's really impressive that he doesn't. But yeah, he was really over. I mean, it's kind of like he was kind of like the Bucky to Captain America there. As far as Sergeant Slaughter, and they played that role perfectly. Slaughter took it very, very seriously. He had this kind of young underling that he was grooming, and the kid was very respectful towards Sergeant Slaughter and the flag, and they played their roles perfectly.
They did. I'm just saying that the WWF, I think, could have gotten a lot more out of that character than they actually did. Steve, we're about to go to the Boston Garden, but we're going to take a little detour, and we're going to listen to an update, a WWF update with Vince McMahon.
This week's update concerns the World Wrestling Federation champion, Hulk Hogan. Many fans feel that Hulk Hogan is perhaps the most charismatic and the most exciting pro wrestling champion ever. A growing swell of enthusiasm for the big Hulkster. A tremendous growing swell of enthusiasm has been given a name, Hulkamania. And indeed, we shall be hearing and seeing lots of Hulkamania as Hulkamania is running wild. Many feel that Hulkamania just a bit more contagious than the common cold. Let's take you to Madison Square Garden, and let's witness some Hulkamania before this capacity crowd jam-packing the arena. The intensity and ferocity of Hulk Hogan, certainly known worldwide. However, there will be many contenders to face the World Wrestling Federation champion, many indeed standing in line to get their mitts on the incredible 303-pound Hulkster.
I like how he gets nonetheless and indeed in there, the ultimate Vince-isms.
Yeah, he sounds like Riley Martin.
I like how he also says many fans feel twice.
Watching this segment, I think Vince did a lot better when he kind of passed off these types of in-house promotional things to people like Mean Gene or Lord Alfred Hayes. I mean, Vince can only swoon so much and get excited too much about Hulk. It was just a little bit too much.
I'm inclined to agree with you. He was, Vince cracks me up because he's Vince and he's what I grew up on. But I mean, I think if you were coming into this cold, you would not have thought this was a very good segment. But having said that, I think having segments like that on the television show were a really good idea. And I think a lot of promotions should have, copied that.
No, absolutely. Because they were selling Hogan so big and working so tirelessly to put him over. I mean, he was already really over with the fans, but kind of reinforcing almost on a weekly basis that this guy is the biggest thing in wrestling, most popular champion. you know, and I've said this analogy before, but the way they marketed him, you felt like rooting for him was like being part of a winning team. Like rooting for the Hulk would be like rooting for, you know, the Celtics or the Dodgers or the, you know, Dallas Cowboys, you know, whatever team was in vogue at the time. And Hogan was that in wrestling. I mean, he was this unbeatable force and a patriot, you know, red, white, and blue, and fans really got behind him.
Yeah, that's one of the great things about wrestling. I mean, it's scripted. You can always write a happy ending and send the fans happy home. Happy, excuse me.
And I think that was, you know, I think that was one of the biggest reasons why this national expansion and the war eventually went the way it did. I mean, WCW, but the NWA, Jim Crockett Promotions, they had these great old school bloody shows with lots of bloodbaths and lots of crazy, insane action in the ring, but oftentimes they'd end the show with a real disappointment, like, oh, Dusty won the title. Oh, no, he didn't. Another referee has come to the ring and the decision has been reversed. And, you know, in the WWF, going all the way back to the Bruno days and the Backlund days too, they had a patent formula of let's send the fans home happy. And they just stuck with that formula, and it's kind of an unbeatable formula.
I agree. And when the NWA, you know, became a national brand under one promotion, JCP, I mean, I absolutely think they should have had a babyface champion, whether it be Rick, you know, turning Ric Flair babyface or just, you know, riding the train with Sting. Speaking of riding, we'll get more into that in a minute. Let's listen to an ad for WWF Magazine.
Newsstand this Tuesday, 68 glossy pages bursting with color and excitement. Come catch the one thing more contagious than the common cold, Hulkamania. Sergeant Slaughter declares war on the Iron Sheik. The rowdiest of them all, Roddy Piper. The Von Erichs, the most dominant family in pro wrestling. The bitter anti-American hatred of the Iron Sheik. Wrestler of the Year, Superfly Jimmy Snuka. Latin Lightning strikes in Boston. Bob Backlund on the comeback trail. These features and more in the World Wrestling Federation official magazine.
One thing Vince really emphasized, 68 pages of color. The wrestling magazines used to be like almost all black and white, except for the cover, and maybe you'd get a centerfold in like Pro Wrestling Illustrated. But no, Vince went all out and had a, frankly, a top rate looking magazine.
Oh, yeah, he really pulled all the stops. And I know after, I think about a year or two later, after his magazines did get a glossy magazine. I think it was called Wrestling 86 or 85, and tried to compete. But yeah, his magazine, Vince's magazine, was all color. And in the early days of the magazine, like you heard in the commercial, they did have little features like a story on the Von Erichs, talking about wrestlers from other promotions. And I know at the time, in those early days, probably the first year or two of the magazine, they even had like historical features. Like they'd have a feature about, say, the Blassie Tolos feud in LA from the early 70s. So it was a lot different than what you'd end up seeing with the Raw magazine or the SmackDown magazine years and years later. But it was definitely a time where Vince was breaking away from the other promotions and also from the magazine publishers as well.
Yep, he broke away from the aftermath, actually all of the other magazines in 1983. So, I mean, he definitely had a vision. I'll give him that. We're doing the show on the national expansion. I have no problem telling you I liked wrestling better before this happened, but, I mean, Vince isn't concerned about me.
No, and it's just, I mean, it just was inevitable, the national expansion. You know, if there wasn't a Vince, I think Jim Crockett would have expanded, certainly not as fast as Vince did. And Vern also tried his hand at going to the West Coast and other areas. But Vince just had the resources to be able to pull this off successfully where the others didn't.
Oh, I agree with you. My theory is that if Vince did not succeed spreading nationally, if he hadn't tried, someone absolutely would have tried to get on pay-per-view. And if you're doing pay-per-view, you got to do nationally. And if Vince didn't succeed, I think pro wrestling would have gone the way of roller derby. It just, you know, it wouldn't be like, oh yeah, then instead of Vince, it was Vern, it was Watts, it was Crockett. No, I think it would have just, for the most part, gone away.
There was a, I was at the library today and I found this book called Glory Days, the summer of 1984. And it's written by John Wortham, who's a, I guess an executive editor at Sports Illustrated. And each chapter of the book talks about 1984 and kind of like pop culture, but more emphasis on sports with Michael Jordan and Wayne Gretzky and what was happening throughout sports and how it touched on pop culture. And there is a chapter in the book about what happened with Vince and Hulk and how the WWF really went to a national expansion and left the other promotions in the dust, so to speak. And it opens up with how the wrestling part of the book opens up. It talks about Lou Albano's meeting with Cyndi Lauper on the China jet plane and how it evolved into him being in the Girls Just Want to Have Fun video and how all that led up to the WWF involvement with MTV, which we'll get to eventually. But those types of things, I mean, like, you know, WWF getting in partnership with MTV, those are the types of things you never would have seen WCW or NWA or Jim Crockett do. I mean, Dusty had a great vision, and he probably would have liked to have seen his product on MTV, but he just didn't have the Madison Avenue types involved and didn't know who to connect with. And that's why Vince was able to do these things and market the WWF like wrestling had never been marketed before.
No, Vince absolutely knew what he was doing. I've always questioned that story about Albano and Lauper meeting on an airplane. I'm not sure exactly what happened, but that sounds kind of worky to me. But I mean, by now, Girls Just Want to Have Fun had been out for about 3 months, and it was just shocking to see Lou Albano on a wrestling video. And little did I know that this was going somewhere.
Yeah, and according to this book, which I just kind of leafed through, it basically said that the record producer, the record label that Cyndi was on, they really were skeptical about how big the song was going to be, and even her album, how big it was going to be, and she supposedly remembered Albano from that infamous flight they were on together, and they were doing the casting, and she wanted her mother to play the mother, and they had a vacancy to fill, and they got Albano to play her dad, and just like you said, John, I mean, to see a wrestling star that we were quite familiar with, Lou Albano on MTV almost every hour on the hour since they were playing that video like nonstop, it was really kind of refreshing and fun to see a familiar face from wrestling on MTV at all hours of the day.
It really was. It was such a departure, and so many things were going to be changing so quickly. But I'll tell you what, let's talk about the Boston Garden Show, March 17th, 1984, and I'll tell you a little bit about what happened beforehand. I usually went with like the same two people, and then there would be people who would just come to a one-off show. Uh-huh. One of the guys I usually go with says to me, "Are you sure you want to go to this show?" I'm like, "You know, yeah, why wouldn't I?" He goes, "Because it's St. Patrick's Day in Boston." And I was like, "Oh, you know what? You're right." So what we came up with was we drove down to Lowell, which is about 15 minutes from here, and we got on the train, and we took the train into Boston, and you know, which we never did. Usually we go into Boston, we park, get a good parking space, you know, so we don't have to take forever being on the roof of the garage or whatever as it's emptying. And yeah, this was just different. We took the train in for, I think this is literally the only time we did that.
Well, let me ask you, and this always interests me about the old days of wrestling, and I know this is during the early days of WWF expansion. Do you recall, like, once you got inside the arena, like, what kind of merch did they have?
They had, starting in 83, they had a merch table where you could buy, like, 8x10s of Bob Backlund and Jimmy Snuka, and that was pretty much it. Mm-hmm. Now that's expanding. You can buy the WWF magazine. You could buy Hulk Hogan t-shirts, like Hulk Hogan foam hands. So it wasn't quite what it was going to be, but you could see it was going in that direction. And, you know, it wasn't just Hulk Hogan. It was Sergeant Slaughter, Jimmy Snuka. That's all I can think of off the top of my head.
Yeah, I remember those days. And I know as we continue with our series, there was a show in Binghamton in August that I attended, and we can talk about that as far as the merch. But that's interesting, is it, because I know in those early days, like my first show I ever attended was in 77, and all they had at that show were the black and white glossies. They had one jumbo-sized poster of Andre that you can get, and then they had the magazines, which were the Norman Keitzer magazines, and occasionally they might have like a ring wrestling before Keitzer had purchased that. But it's interesting to see how the merchandise had evolved.
Yeah, definitely. And again, oddly enough, Southwest Championship Wrestling tried to do that when they were on USA Network. And I would love what I would give to find out how many people bought an I Hate Tully t-shirt or a Bob Sweetan banner. I mean, they were selling some crazy stuff, and I have no idea whether or not it sold. I'm dying to know this.
we'll have to research that, I guess.
I don't know where we would look. I really don't. But that's one of my all-time curiosity questions of, you know, how well that stuff moved.
Now, 2 weeks ago on our last show, we did some major hype for the card itself. I know we had the big matchup with Colonel Fuji against Sergeant Slaughter. Do you have any recollection of how that match went?
I do remember that Slaughter pretty much destroyed the Sheik. Mr. Fuji. Mr. Fuji sneak attacked Slaughter before the match, and Slaughter came right back and basically squashed him, and the place was going nuts. On a scale of 1 to 10, Boston Garden going nuts, this was like a 9.5.
Wow. And you remember, was the Intercontinental match between Santana and Iron Mike Sharp, was it a competitive match?
It was, and it was a good match. It was actually, you know, back then I didn't go into wrestling shows looking for work rate, but if a match stood out as being good, I remembered it, and this was a good match. Iron Mike Sharp had his working shoes on. Another thing about this show, the opener was the Invaders defeating Akira Maeda and Fred Marzino. Like, little did I know, I didn't even know who Maeda was. And 5 years later, this guy would be selling out the Tokyo Dome.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I did some research on Maeda's run here, since he's still, this is kind of the beginning of his tour. As it turns out, he worked March, April, and May for WWF. And his legend has gone on, and I think Dave Meltzer had said this. This tour was where Maeda learned that he hated American wrestling, and he was doing jobs for the likes of George Steele and Rene Goulet. He did get an occasional win against Iran Shah or Israel Mattia, but those wins would be very few and far between on this tour.
Nope, that's what I heard a long time ago, that, you know, basically this tour made him hate the cartoonish aspect of wrestling, and he, you know, years later, he would open up his own promotion that was a lot more, looked more real than the average wrestling match, but at the same time, it was as real as your typical wrestling match. You know, it was all worked.
Right, of course. And, saving the best for last, what are your memories and recollections of the main event, Hulk Hogan against Dr. D, David Schultz?
In 1985, and we'll talk more about this later, I got my first VCR. And, of course, the first thing I do is I start renting wrestling videos from the video store. Mm-hmm. They had on the Hulkamania tape, they had Hogan versus Dr. D from Minneapolis.
Right.
And I remember when I watching this saying, I've already seen this match. It was practically the same match as they had in Boston. Mm-hmm. Both guys bloodied up. It was a great brawl. Just an excellent match.
Any memories of the Andre versus the Matt Superstar match?
Yeah, Superstar bounced around like a pinball for Andre. Andre got the pin. Then after the pin, Andre tried to take off the mask, and Superstar just like escaped and ran back to the dressing room.
Now, I'm really going to test your memory. I know you've said on some of the Stick to Wrestling podcasts that one of your favorite portions of the show was that period right before the end of the show where they would say, oh, and coming next month. Do you remember anything about that?
I do. I specifically remember this. They announced the main event was going to be Sergeant Slaughter against the Iron Sheik, and the place popped. And I'm like, you know, sitting there, okay, who's Hulk Hogan going to wrestle? I'm waiting. And no Hulk Hogan announcement. And the next Boston Garden show was the last time that either Bob Backlund didn't defend the title or Bruno Sammartino wasn't in the main event since Superstar Billy Graham was champion. It blew my mind. I'm like, wait a minute, it's the Boston Garden. There's a title match. And no, there wasn't. And we'll talk more about it later, but I mean, the place either sold out or came close to selling out.
That's very interesting, because when we reviewed the next MSG card, we're going to run into that same situation, which is definitely showing the change of promotion from the old school WWF, where the champion was always in the main event, to a new style of promoting, which we'll get into.
Yeah, and the new style, which you know, we talked about before, I mean, they were running, you know, two or three towns a night, and thus you're making two or three, grossing two or three more times money, and that's, you know, the vision that Vince had.
Wow. And I also wanted to tell you, just for, if you're wondering to yourself since you attended this show, you know, what the heck was going on in the rest of the wrestling world. This night in Greensboro, North Carolina, they actually had a card called Boogie Jam 84, which I bet you're familiar with.
I am. I remember the t-shirts from it, but
really?
I mean, you know, that, I mean, we're seeing the wrestling world, it's changing. I mean, Greensboro the year before had the big night where it was Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood against Sergeant Slaughter and Don Kernodle, and the traffic was messed up. There was so much interest in that match, and then they had Starrcade, and now they're branding these events like, you know, Boogie Jam 84. So it's changing now. It's getting bigger.
Well, I'm just going to quickly run through this card just so you can kind of see from a national expansion viewpoint what the WWF was up against as far as their main competition. This is Jim Crockett Promotions in Greensboro, North Carolina. They had Tully Blanchard defeating Dory Funk Jr., who I think may have been the booker at the time. Rufus R. Jones defeated Ernie Ladd. NWA Tag Team Champions Wahoo McDaniel and Mark Youngblood defeated Don Kernodle and Bob Orton Jr. in a non-title match. A six-man match, Angelo Mosca Sr. and Jr. and the Junkyard Dog defeated Gary Hart, the Great Kabuki, and Ivan Koloff. Dick Slater defeated Greg Valentine in a no-DQ steel cage match, which is interesting since Valentine's already working part-time in the WWF. And in the main event, Ric Flair fought Ricky Steamboat to a 60-minute time limit draw. And then they had a special gimmick match, bonus match. Jimmy Valiant with Dusty Rhodes in his corner defeated Assassin number 2 with Paul Jones in a hair versus mask match. So quite an interesting card, and quite different than the card you attended.
Very different. I mean, I would have loved to have seen a 60-minute draw between Flair and Steamboat at this time. I'm pretty sure Dory Funk Jr. was the booker in Mid-Atlantic at this point. And I think it was right around this time the Memphis promotion begged Jimmy Valiant to come back. I mean, they needed him to draw money, and they actually bought him a house, Jerry Jarrett and Jerry Lawler. And Valiant accepted, and a few weeks into it, he gave his notice by handing, I think it was Jerry Jarrett, the keys to that house. It was like, you know, unspoken, because he just made more money in the Carolinas.
That's amazing. And looking at this card, and I'm not a true Jim Crockett Promotions historian, I was surprised to see JYD on the card. I didn't know he really had a run in that promotion, but apparently he did.
He did until the WWF hired him away. At this point, Mid-South had actually sent him away purposely for, and Jim Duggan actually was away in Florida too. They wanted the babyface focus to be on Magnum TA.
Oh, I see. Yeah, it's an interesting card. And I know just from the research that this card has appeared on the old WWE Network. And I don't know if it's uploaded on the Peacock, but it should be out there eventually.
Well, yeah, by this point, they're saying that everything will be, you know, will be out on Peacock. They were saying by SummerSlam. So that's like 2 weeks away from when we're recording this. I did not know that was on WWE Network. As soon as it goes on Peacock, I'm checking out that Flair Steamboat match.
Oh yeah, and I mean, it almost goes without saying, but it definitely needs to be said. The Steamboat Flair matches were state of the art at the time, and the matches were so superb and so outstanding. Even today, they hold up incredibly well.
Oh, I think so. I went to the New Jersey Meadowlands. I guess we'll talk about this we're at the time frame when that show's out, but I went to the New Jersey Meadowlands to see Flair versus Steamboat. It was like something I'd never seen before. It's by far the greatest match I'd ever seen. And then I start getting the newsletters and I start hearing that, yeah, they had kind of a down night that night in New Jersey. I was like, oh man.
That's amazing when you realize just how good they are, and it was considered an off night.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, that's what it said in the newsletters, at least, and you know, we all know what great matches they had in 1989.
Wow. Any other thoughts or memories about the Boston card?
Not really. I mean, I remember being very happy with the show. I mean, the Hogan Schultz match was really good. Slaughter versus Mr. Fuji had so much heat, and the place was salivating for Sergeant Slaughter against Iron Sheik, and the WWF was going to deliver in 4 weeks later.
Yeah, I mean, I know had I been in attendance with you there, I would have been thinking, God, like, I want a title match. But when you hear these two are finally going to get it on in person right in front of you, that's more than enough to make up for not seeing the title match.
And the thing is, I was like, you know, what's Hulk Hogan doing? Sitting at home? Like, little did I realize he was in Japan.
Right. Yeah, it was a different style. Now that, like you said, there are so many different house shows they're running at one time, and of course with him, he had other obligations. But it definitely interesting times for the WWF.
You know, here's one way of looking at it. Like, of course, the WWF had heated feuds that did not include the WWF champion, like the year before Don Morocco against Jimmy Snuka. But we still had a Bob Backlund title match, even though we had Morocco and Snuka in the cage. So that took a little bit of getting used to on my end.
Yeah, I think the thing I liked about it is when they deviated from it, I guess, as we talk about this year and the years that would follow. Like, I know, like, as an example, we use the middle part of 1986. There was a period there where Hogan was completely gone from MSG for about four months in a row, I think. And they basically let the Santana against Savage feud, you know, carried a four-month set at MSG, which eventually led to the matches where Adrian Adonis and Bruno got involved. And seeing those types of matches that were really high quality and better, I didn't mind it. With, you know, they kind of made, you know, having Bruno in the main event or someone of that nature, I thought that made up for Noah Hogan was fine. But you know, there just has to be something special to replace the champion, and the champion's not going to be there. So
yeah, I mean, that was the new reality, that they were going to two or three major markets on a Friday or Saturday or a Sunday, and only one of them's going to get Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, absolutely.
All American Wrestling continues to decline. We have two matches, Iron Mike Sharp versus Chief J Strongbow. I don't have a result for that, but I'm guessing Strongbow won. And Jimmy Snuka versus Mr. Fuji from St. Louis. Not to overdo this, but I mean, I'm thinking if you're on USA Network, have a decent product. Come on.
Yeah, they went from having these nice matches from the other promotions, and they kind of really got sloppy, and we're just, you know, taking a couple of matches from Championship Wrestling, a couple from All Star, and maybe eventually they would add in, you know, house show matches from the Garden or other places. But yeah, these shows were just, you know, repeats for the most part.
No, it seemed like it was already a throwaway show. Mm-hmm. Dayton, Ohio, March 19th, 1984, gets a main event of Andre the Giant and Masked Superstar. Andre the Giant defeats Masked Superstar. Then we go to Cincinnati, March 20th, 1984. Andre wins a battle royal. Tito Santana beats Masked Superstar. Jimmy Snuka defeats Samoan Afa. Sergeant Slaughter beats Tiger Chung Lee. So a decent outing in Cincinnati. I don't have an attendance for that. Then Pittsburgh on March 23rd. That's a Friday. Main event is a $15,000 Battle Royal won by Andre the Giant. And if it's Battle Royal night, you know you're not getting any other decent matches. I'd say the next match down might have been Andre the Giant versus Iron Mike Sharp or Sergeant Slaughter versus Samoan Afa. So a rough night in Pittsburgh.
No, but that show actually drew well, though, 16,500. And it's like, maybe they went home disappointed. Maybe they were happy to see Andre win. But, you're correct. The undercard was very, very poor.
Well, I mean, I've talked about this on Stick to Wrestling. I mean, Battle Royal night, it sounded like the greatest thing in the world. And after the Battle Royal, guys are going to be hurt. It was going to be a violent, brutal match. And the dressing room was going to be like a triage unit. And the promoters would scramble to put matches together based on who was available. And you grew to learn that just meant you were getting a Battle Royal, which those weren't any good anyway, and a terrible undercard.
Well, this particular one is really bad because it's like more than half of the wrestlers working the undercard were enhancement talent. So it's like it's hard to really cobble together some good competitive matches.
I mean, really, here are the other participants: Iron Sheik, Jimmy Jackson, TV jobber, Butcher Vershawn, old guy, Jose Luis Rivera, TV jobber, Ivan Putski, we'll talk more about him later, the Samoans, Charlie Fulton, who never won, Fred Marzino, who never won, Rene Goulet, who never won, Bill Dixon, TV jobber, Mr. Fuji, mid-card guy, SD Jones, we all know his deal, Akira Maeda, Iron Mike Sharp, and Tiger Chung Lee. So that's your roster, and not a very good one, but it drew.
Yeah, I think just the nature of the Battle Royal. I mean, I think compared to a lot of the other promotions, the WWF wasn't known for having Battle Royals. So just the novelty of having it apparently drew this nice gate.
Well, I mean, you know what? We'll talk more about this later, but Pittsburgh was a good WWF town, and usually you go to see the wrestling rather than a particular wrestler. That's the way I've always seen it, at least.
It was definitely a great, not only a WWF town, but a great wrestling town because, I have to admit, Dusty Rhodes and Big Bubba from the NWA, they actually set the gate attendance for Pittsburgh for wrestling. You would have assumed it was a Bruno match or a Hogan match, but Dusty and Ray Traylor had the biggest gate ever in Pittsburgh. I think it's been broken, but at the time they set a new record.
No, that was the beginning of 1987, and yeah, that was a big shock to everyone. And you're right, I guess that qualifies Pittsburgh as being a really good wrestling town. WWF is also that night in St. Louis. It's a TV taping. Salvatore Bellomo beats Billy Travis. Yes, that Billy Travis of Memphis wrestling fame got his start in the WWF. Dr. D. David Schultz over Chief J. Strongbow. Paul Orndorff over Brian Blair. I actually saw this match. It was really good. Tito Santana over Alexis Smirnoff. I don't know what he's doing in St. Louis. Spike Huber over Max Blue, a couple of WWA guys. Jimmy Snuka over Pete Darty. Big John Studd with Roddy Piper in his corner defeats Hulk Hogan via countout. I also have seen that match. And Tony Atlas and Rocky Johnson defeat Adrian Adonis and Dick Murdoch by disqualification. And the heels, Spike pile drive. The babyface is on the floor and Tony Atlas was taken out on the stretcher.
Wow. I mean, that definitely creates heat and also really begins the potential of a feud between these two top teams.
Definitely. And, well, once again, I mentioned last week we had not seen Adonis and Murdoch on the main WWF television yet. When we do, they're going to make some waves. Before we start talking about the long weekend of wrestling, March 24th, 1984, let's listen to a promo for the next upcoming Boston Garden show, which is April 14th, 1984.
Fans, as you know, the Boston Garden, a facility, a tremendous facility with so much wrestling tradition. On the next big card coming up here, it is going to be Sergeant Slaughter meeting the Iron Sheik. Now, Freddie Blassie contends, Sergeant, that you fell into a well-placed trap by the two of them. I don't know if I agree or not.
They keep saying that the United States is prejudiced, that they've been through Bob Backlund and Hulk Hogan, and now they're bringing the Marine.
Nobody sent me. Nobody sent me Iron Sheik. I came on my own, like I've always done. I've always been a loner, you maggot. You scum. You slime. How dare you? How dare you attack me when I'm saluting the greatest flag in the world, United States of America? Let me tell you, Iron Sheik, when you walk into that arena, you're going to hear the people. You're going to hear the shake of the earth. You're going to hear the national anthem, and everybody there is going to be on their feet standing. Then, when you get in that ring, you're going to hear that famous song all over the world, the greatest of them all, the Halls of Montezuma.
Oh.
The Halls of Montezuma, and then you're going to see this ugly face. You're going to see me coming at you, Iron Sheik. And when it's all over, you know what song you're going to hear?
What song, Sergeant?
Taps.
Oh, my.
Taps! And then we're going to the hospital, Iron Sheik. We're going to try to figure out a way to get my size 13 and a half inch combat boot out of your rear end.
Well, ladies,
as you were.
Well, I thank you. A very patriotic, very patriotic Sergeant Slaughter. Actually, in reality, he is looking forward to his meeting with the Iron Sheik, this big grudge match on the next big card right here.
I like how after Slaughter says they're going to play the Halls of Montezuma, Gene Okerlund goes, oh.
Yeah, I caught that too. It was kind of hilarious.
Gene was an acquired taste for me. I can tell you right now that on March 24th, 1984, I did not like Gene Okerlund at all. But obviously, over the years, he has grown on me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he became really good. But here in the beginning days, he is just he's just making himself be acquainted with the fans, I guess.
All right, more audio. But before we listen to that, I just want to remind everyone that all audio on the National Expansion Podcast is for review purposes only. And with that, let's go to an update.
This week's update concerns former World Wrestling Federation champion, Mr. Bob Backlund. In an article in the official World Wrestling Federation magazine entitled The End of an Era, it documents Mr. Backlund's rise to the World Wrestling Federation to the top rung of the ladder and documents as well his injuries sustained, however, in the match against the Iron Sheik and his fall. But also, ladies and gentlemen, it documents his determination. And it's his determination, his drive that took him to the top rung of the ladder that's likely to take him right back up there again. Let's take you now to a recent interview with Bob Backlund, along with two of the principals from the Bob Backlund's Kids Tournament at his side. Let's go to the videotape.
You know, a lot of people think I was down, and I got to admit I was down. But, you know, when I was down, I found out how many friends I really had. I found out how many people were really behind me, and that really meant a lot. And I want to thank you all for all those letters, all that support. And every time I thought I was maybe finished, I went back and read a little letter, and you people said, in our hearts, you're still the champion. And I really appreciate that.
Since that interview, Mr. Backlund has stated quite flatly that, yes, indeed, he is back at a 100% capacity and looking forward to climbing up to the top rung of the ladder. We'll look forward to Bob Backlund.
Steve, one thing I think I'm good at is I can put myself back in the mindset to where I was on or around March 24th, 1984, starting about 1980 or 81, like I started really disliking Bob Backlund. And that grew and grew as time went on. And by this point, I absolutely could not stand him. How did you feel about Bob Backlund?
you know, it's hard for me to even say any words. When he came on the scene, I mean, he had a really tall challenge ahead of him because Bruno had been champion for a long time. Billy Graham became an extremely popular bad guy champion, for lack of a better word, for 10 months or so. And Bob Backlund, as we all know, the behind the scenes story, had been chosen by Vince the Elder to be the replacement, to be the next babyface champion, kind of in the mold of a Jack Briscoe type, but he wanted to make him the All-American Boy. And I really was impressed by Bob's wrestling and everything, his acumen as a wrestler, but I never really liked the persona of Bob Backlund, whether it was the All-American Boy or the whatever it was that followed. So the 6 years of him being champion, and I really became a huge heel fan, always rooting for the heels. So eventually Iron Sheik defeats him out of the blue, which was a shock. And now Bob Backlund is kind of in this quandary of, well, I'm not the champion anymore. I don't really have a role anymore. And even this promo that Vince is cutting, it's like, it doesn't really tell you what is there left for Bob Backlund. He's hosting an amateur wrestling thing for kids. He's obviously going to wrestle somebody. But at this point, 1984, it just seems like he's just a man without a country. He's just out there somewhere. And he just didn't seem to have any place in this new version of the WWF.
He really didn't. I mean, you know, we'll talk about more about this, you know, as time goes on. But I mean, you would think he would have some value as a nostalgia act, maybe put him in a tag team or something like that. But I mean, Bob showed up, if I recall correctly, and I kind of know I do. I saw him for the first time Christmas Day 1976, and he's been here for a long time now, and maybe it's just time for the curtain to go down. I mean, it happens to everyone in wrestling.
Yeah, it does. And I kind of think, you know, if the plan that Vince had for him was ultimately to turn into a heel and go that route, and of course, he never agreed to do that, it seems almost like this kind of a promo is like, well, are we going to make him kind of like the Elder Statesman? Is he going to be like kind of our new living legend? And as time went on, if I'm remembering correctly, I think Backlund would continue to wrestle for WWF even into the summer of 84. And before you know it, Bruno and his son came in around August of 84, I think. And it's like, well, you've got the real living legend now. Are we going to have two living legends? So I think, I don't know what time Backlund left compared to when Bruno came in. But in one world, if Bruno hadn't come in, maybe they could have billed him as something like a living legend, like a, you know, a WWF icon from the past. And maybe they could have kind of gone in that direction with him. But it seems like the fans didn't really resonate with the fans anymore. Once he lost the belt, it was like Superman became Clark Kent. You know, it was different about him.
Yeah, Backlund's popularity was declining before he lost the title. I think Jimmy Snuka taking over as the lead babyface, or in reality, the number one babyface, hurt him. And now Bob's moving further down the trough. You've got Hulk Hogan ahead of him, Sergeant Slaughter ahead of him. Snuka is now ahead of him since Backlund's not the champion. And all three of those guys, the fans saw them as cool. You know, Bob's Bob. He is who he is, and that's just not a cool guy.
I don't think there's any way that they could have recycled or repackaged him other than the, you know, kind of the road that eventually happened with him years later, where he became kind of this, you know, lunatic heel. And he says he said that you know, fans were tired of him being so good, so he wanted to have them boo him for being so good, and that's how that convoluted character began. But I was just tired of his act. I really was.
No, I was beyond sick of Bob Backlund at this point. And like I said, he just got pushed further and further down the trough. And like you said, there may have been a living legend role for him at some point, but what do you do with him then? You know, I mean, have him challenge for the Intercontinental title, put him in a tag team. I mean, like you say, he was like a man without a country.
Yeah, he was. And I think the WWF, I mean, the reason why they became such a juggernaut, besides the obvious, like Hulk and Vince together and things like that, I mean, they were marketing guys who had either incredible personality like Piper or guys that had an incredible look like Orndorff, and Backlund just didn't have any of those. I mean, what he had was the old school wrestling ability, and as we know from how we've talked about the cards and the matches, having great wrestling ability was kind of on the low end of what was important to the WWF in this time frame.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I've said this before, the WWF and the wrestling business in general was going in one direction, and Bob was running towards the other direction. It just was no longer a fit. I mean, I have grown to appreciate Bob Backlund, especially in the ring, but it's just, I've said this before, it speaks volumes that in the middle of a wrestling war, no one wanted him.
Yeah, I think, there was a teeny tiny window. I think it was one of the Pro Wrestling USA tapings where he was involved in some kind of an angle, and he actually manhandled some top wrestler. I don't know if it was one of the Road Warriors or someone, but it was like...
It was Ron Bass.
Ron Bass. Okay. So, you know, not a top guy, but a, you know, at least a mid-level guy. And, he, maybe in a completely different promotion with a different mindset, like even like a Bill Watts promotion. I mean, just have him go in as a kick-ass, no-nonsense guy, still a baby face. But yeah, in the WWF of this age where it was much more entertainment-based, he just didn't have the skill set to succeed and to thrive like he used to.
No, and two quick things about Bob Backlund. Number one, I mean, like I said, it speaks volumes in like 85, 86 that JCP or Watts did not bring him in. And I don't know where or how he would have fit in those promotions. But number two, you know what? Bob saved his money and he didn't have to take just whatever the best offer was. Good for him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And we've talked about his book before. And in the book, he talks about how frugal he was and what a smart investor he was. And he's had several successful businesses. And he's really, besides the persona of being a crazy guy, he definitely handles his money well. So, you know, more power to him for that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Bob was talking about in this interview, you know, he would, you know, get down and then he'd read a letter that someone sent him and it would make him feel better. If I had thought of it as someone who was 18 years old at this point, I absolutely would have sent him a letter and would have said, "You stink, quit wrestling." Anyway, that's how tired I was of Bob Backlund. Wow. One last thing, let's hear some audio regarding WWF Magazine.
Sale now. Come celebrate in the locker room with the new World Wrestling Federation champion Hulk Hogan. Stand at attention for Sergeant Slaughter. Just how rowdy is Roddy Piper, the Von Erich, the most dominant family in professional wrestling. A lavish shopping spree by the Iron Sheik, Wrestler of the Year, Superfly, Jimmy Snuka. Tito Santana's impossible dream comes true. How did Big John Studd become $30,000 richer in less than 14 minutes? And just how wonderful is Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff? These features and more in the official World Wrestling Federation magazine on sale now.
Okay, and again, all audio that we're using is for review purposes only. Now let's go to Championship Wrestling that aired on Saturday, the 24th of March. Tito Santana defeats Tony Russo. Paul Orndorff defeats Johnny Ringo. I would never let a jobber on TV with a name like that. Sergeant Slaughter defeats Ron Shaw. Tonga Kid had over Angelo Gomez. The tag team champions, Rocky Johnson and Tony Atlas, defeat Charlie Fulton and Israel Mattia. Dr. D. David Schultz defeats Steve Lombardi, and Bob Backlund makes his first single wrestling appearance since losing the title, defeating Tiger Chung Lee. And finally, Iron Mike Sharp defeats Victor Mercado. Steve, the WWF TV was always very slow moving, and that really never changed until Raw came on.
Well, I will say that when we got to this beginning of the national expansion, it got more exciting because you just didn't know who was going to show up. I mean, eventually we're going to have guys come in like the Freebirds will be in briefly. Who's the one heel guy that was managed by Albano briefly?
Buzz Sawyer.
I mean, we're gonna have people just pop in and out. And I thought that made 84 in the beginning of 85 very exciting when all of a sudden you had these newcomers just come in and come and go. And that was one of the most exciting parts of the national expansion, just these newcomers, matriculating in and out of the Federation and making the cards a lot more exciting.
No, you're right. I mean, you would tune in every week to see, you know, who's the next guy the WWF poached from either Georgia or the AWA. And I've kind of put away the scorecard on that because we're in a little bit of a lull here, but we'll definitely have the tally for you by the end of 1984. Let me see. All-Star Wrestling has... Oh, you know what? Before we do All-Star Wrestling, let's go to more of audio. We'll hear a little bit about the upcoming Boston Garden Show.
The World Wrestling Federation returning here to this great city, the Boston Garden, Saturday night, April 14th, 8 o'clock start. From top to bottom, this one simply spectacular, with two gigantic world title bouts to be part of this card. Greg the Hammer Valentine, come on in if you would at this time. I want to talk to you single match with a very impressive young man who has arrived recently in the World Wrestling Federation by the name of B. Brian Blair. Great amateur background and a great talent now in the professional ranks.
Well, yes, he is a very great talent, young upstart. I'd like to say what B stands for. B. Brian bum. Blair stands for bum. Bum, that's a good one. Bum. But Beeper is really what it stands for. That's what his parents used to call him. That was his nickname in high school and college, Beeper Brian Blair. And he hates to be called Beeper, but I'm going to call you that, Beeper, especially when I get you down your back and just slap you upside your face. Now, I understand that you've come a long, long way in a short time. But in a Boston Garden, my first time back in a couple of years, I intend on instilling one heck of an impression on you and all the fans. Remember, I'm the master of the figure four leg lock, and if I have to, if you do not give up, if I have to, I'll break your leg right there in front of all those people in the Boston Garden, and I'll enjoy every minute of it.
What we're trying to say, Gene, is that Brian Blair is merely a stepping stone. Bummy right. Brian Blair.
We're going to find out, gentlemen, in short order. Big, big date coming up here at the Boston Garden. Saturday night, April the 14th. Ladies and gentlemen, do get your tickets in advance. One of the matches they're talking about, not only here in Boston, but throughout the entire professional wrestling world. The Iron Sheik, to meet my guest at this time, is, of course, from Parris Island, South Carolina. I am talking about Sergeant Slaughter. I wonder if I could prevail upon the sergeant. Sergeant Slaughter, excuse me if you would, please. I realize you're in consultation with the latest inductee into the Cobra Corps, but the Iron Sheik one-on-one in the Boston Garden, April 14th.
You know, Iron Sheik, you maggot, you scum, you slime. We finally get to meet in the Boston Gardens. They've been putting hurdles in front of me ever since you attacked me on television. Ever since you put your face next to mine and threw out a challenge, there's been hurdles in my way, but I've jumped over every one of them, and now there's nowhere for you to go. Right there in the Boston Garden, how dare you? How dare you strike me when I'm saluting the greatest flag in the world, the American flag, Old Glory, USA. Well, Iron Sheik, I know all these people in Boston like to see a good fight. I know that when I come to Boston, even though it's noted for their green, I'm sure they won't mind seeing a little red, white, and blue with the Iron Sheik's face.
The words of Sergeant Slaughter, tremendous bad blood and animosity developing and currently existing between these two men, Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff, Rowdy Roddy Piper, one-on-one with former World's Heavyweight
right.
Champion,
former
the great
World's Heavyweight
Bob
Champion.
Backlund.
You know what that means? That means he can be beat. And you know
camera.
The word is, I'm not facing them, cameras. Those people ain't going to get a good look at me. You know how many families I've broken up by looking at that family?
Oh.
That's why I don't look at it. But the word is out that Bob Backlund's injury is not 100% fixed yet. Mm. It's not 100% healed. Well, I want you to know one thing, Backlund. I know about it. I got my people out looking. I got my people out scouting around, and we know what your problem is. And I'm going to show those people in Boston. You know, I'm sick and tired of those people calling me Paula. Everywhere I turn out there, signs, posters, it's on the billboards, it's everywhere. They're calling me Paula. I got a 21-inch arm, 32-inch legs, and they're calling me Paula. Every time they call me Paula, Backlund, I'm going to hurt you a little bit more, boy. You think about it. The more they call me Paula, the more I'm going to hurt you. They're going to carry you out of that ring.
You may not even have an arm left when I get through with it.
Roddy, Piper, quickly.
Besides that, there ain't never been an Irishman that could beat a Scotsman at nothing, let alone somebody like Mr. Wonderful. You're going to take Bob Backlund? Oh, yes, he's strong. He's a tremendous wrestler.
I'm going to try my best. I'm a wonderful human being.
That ain't going to cut it. You don't need to be wonderful human being. There's only one Mr. Wonderful. You need to get down.
Adam and I don't like to be rude. The big one coming up at the Boston Garden when the World Wrestling Federation returns to town Saturday night, April the 14th.
Once again, anytime we use audio, it's for review purposes only. Paul Orndorff was very funny in this clip. He had his back to the camera the entire time.
Yeah, he was trying to prevent more families from breaking up, which is a good thing.
I guess it depends on the family. but anyway, All-Star Wrestling has SD Jones defeating Tony Colon. This is from March 24th, 1984. Brian Blair, Tony Garea over Tony Russo and Charlie Fulton. What's the word I'm looking for? Rerun, Bob Backlund versus Tiger Chung Lee from Championship Wrestling. And Salvatore Bellomo defeats Victor Mercado. I am a big believer, Steve, in having a guy like SD Jones, Brian Blair, Tony Garea, Salvatore Bellomo go over on TV, but not three matches on one TV show. You got to have some star power out there.
Yeah, I kind of think, with the WWF expanding so quickly in these new markets, I think whoever was in charge of some of the TV were just almost like throwing matches together and not really picking ones that would really count, and I can understand too that, like, hey, let's put the better matches in the arenas and have people come out and watch them, have some of the lackluster matches on TV so they get bored and they want to see good matches. I don't know, but there could have been definitely a better quality of matches than the ones that appeared on TV each week.
Oh, definitely. I mean, everything was a squash in the WWF. They maybe had, at least coming into 1984, they maybe had like four or five competitive matches on TV per year. And as time goes on, and we'll talk more about this, now you're on cable TV, so you're having shows from like the Landover Center, Madison Square Garden, and next year they're going to have Saturday Night's Main Event, which was nothing but, top caliber matches.
Right. Yeah, their biggest fear, same with any promoter was, if you give them good matches, they're not going to come to the arenas. But the WWF had done such a great job of going to these new markets, and a lot of markets that were just wrestling starved, like the Michigan area and different cities that just hadn't really been addressed. A lot of the older promotions that had shut down. Here they are, a brand new product with big stars like Hogan and Orndorff and Piper and Slaughter, and the fans were eating it up. They're really excited to see this new product in their town.
Especially, like you said, in the Midwest, where wrestling had been on its back for a long time. I mean, obviously, look how well WrestleMania 3 did in the Midwest. So, big show in Los Angeles, the Olympic Auditorium, Saturday, March 24th, 1984. Salvatore Bellomo over Jack Armstrong, Alexis Smirnoff over Mickey Doyle. Al Madrill and Brian Blair defeat Jay York and Adrian Adonis. Dick Murdoch was a no-show for some reason. Sergeant Slaughter defeats the Masked Superstar. Tito Santana defeats Paul Orndorff via DQ after 20 minutes and 57 seconds of action. I'll bet that was good. Big John Studd defeats Rick Drayson. I'm not sure what the point of that was. And Hulk Hogan defeats Dr. D. David Schultz via pinfall at 5 minutes and 26 seconds. Wow, that's kind of a lackluster main event.
Definitely. I know as time progresses and we get into a lot more Hogan's better matches and better opponents, his matches, for the most part, would usually run anywhere from like 9 minutes to maybe 14, 15 minutes, but usually not longer than that. But his whole act, from the big entrance with lots of music and posing, and his after match routine with lots of music and posing, I think all that made the matches seem longer than they really were. But I always felt, you know, as a fan who saw him live and also from the big events that I watched him wrestle at, I always felt I got my money's worth with Hogan. I thought his wrestling was definitely better than a lot of the smart fans give him credit for. And if he, you know, had the right opponent, he could have a very exciting match.
I think you just made a really good point about, you know, with the Hogan ring entrance and then the post-match celebration, how that made the matches seem a little bit longer. I still think 5.5 minutes for a main event, especially in a market as vital as Los Angeles, like, just do another 4 or 5 minutes, dude.
Yeah, I agree completely. I mean, I don't know. Maybe there's something that we didn't know. Like maybe one of them was injured or something. But whatever it was, I mean, they should have stalled. They should have done something to give the fans a feeling that they got their money's worth on this night.
No, I agree with you. Same night, the WWF is in Akron, Ohio at something called the Physical Education Building. I want this guy named, whoever named it that, I want him naming stuff for me. Another lackluster card with Andre the Giant winning a battle royal and a little more star power this time. We've got Tony Atlas and Ivan Putski, Rocky Johnson in there. But other than that, kind of a flat card. Then we go to Sunday. All-American Wrestling has the Invaders versus Brian Blair and Tony Garea. I don't have a result for that. That's kind of an interesting match.
Yeah, that is a unique match. I mean, two kind of like mid-level or lower-level tag teams going against each other in a scientific match too, which is rare for this time frame.
Yeah, we also have Big John Studd against Steve Lombardi and the Moondogs versus Eddie Gilbert and Terry Daniels from St. Louis. The Moondogs are not on any of the main shows, but I guess they soon would be.
Yeah, they kind of, I would say that they kind of took the place of Fuji and Chung Lee as that kind of a lower level heel tag team act, and they did their jobs okay, but I was never a fan of the Moondogs.
No, I always found the Moondogs to be embarrassing. Never liked them. Well, actually, I liked them when they were in Memphis in the early 90s, but in the WWF, I did not like their run as tag team champions. All right, to show how big the WWF is, how this thing is a license to print money. They usually had their Madison Square Garden shows on Monday night, but this time they're having it in Madison Square Garden, Sunday, March 25th, and it's a matinee, and they drew 26,092 people for this show. SD Jones defeats Rene Goulet. Brian Blair defeats Charlie Fulton. Now, here's an interesting match. WWF International Championship Tournament Finals. Akira Maeda defeats Pierre Lefebvre via submission at 4:55. Prior to the match, Hisashi Shinma, the WWF president, was introduced to the crowd and then presented Maeda with the belt after the match. So I guess that's part of what Maeda's doing here. I have been told that around this era, to the Japanese wrestlers, appearing at Madison Square Garden was the equivalent of appearing at a WrestleMania. It was that big a deal, and that's why they did the title switch here, because it meant so much more to the Japanese audience that it happened at Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, I kind of feel bad, like, you know, I mean, even in that era, I mean, I was probably in my early 20s then, but I'd like to suspend disbelief and, you know, this guy is winning this important match at the Garden, but meanwhile, he's going to Allentown, losing to Jose Luis Rivera. He's losing it to other people in other cities. I mean, it would have been nice if they just let him continue to win in other cities. I mean, they had done that with other towns from the past, like Yatsu or some other guys had been in before, and they let him kind of just win preliminary matches, which wouldn't have hurt anything. But they just had him lose a ton of job matches in this 3-month period he worked. It would have been nice if he just kept him undefeated, but, you know, I'm not the booker, so.
Yeah. I mean, there was really no purpose in having him lose to Rene Goulet. you know, it's kind of a slap in the face to New Japan Pro Wrestling, to be honest with you.
I agree with that. Mm-hmm.
All right. Steve, have you ever attended a wrestling show at Madison Square Garden?
No, I have not. I've been there for hockey and other things, but not for wrestling, no.
At least you went to Madison Square Garden. I mean, I went once And I'm just happy I did. It was August 1982, Bob Backlund against Playboy Buddy Rose. And it was a long night, and it messed up my schedule. But at least I have – and we had bad seats. But at least I have that memory, and I can say, hey, I went to a show at Madison Square Garden. If anything, I regret not going to another one, because when I was in my early 20s, it would have been easy. Just get on Amtrak and go.
I was talking to this one lady I worked for in a professional setting years ago, and really a nice professional lady. She was in management with this company, and somehow wrestling came up, and she used to live in the New York City area. And I just asked her, I said, did you ever go to the Garden for wrestling? And she said, oh, yeah, me and my family, we went many times to see Bruno. It was like, and she was of Italian descent, and it was like, it was just like a no-brainer. It was the thing to do would be to go to wrestling in the Garden. And I wish I had done it, and I'm glad that you got to experience it. But it's just funny to kind of look at the different eras of wrestling. I'm sure that the people that you know have gone in the 90s and the 2000s and since, it's kind of like going to see like Icecapades or some other things. I mean, it's a great show. I mean, I'm not knocking it, but it's just a different, completely different than any of the eras that we're talking about.
Oh, totally. I mean, if you're going to Madison Square Garden to see wrestling now, I mean, you know, don't even bother. It's just, you know, it's not the same anymore, and it's just another house show. Whereas back during this time, Madison Square Garden was, you know, the wrestling arena.
Absolutely.
And that's coming from someone who grew up going to the Boston Garden. I can admit it. Madison Square Garden was it. Anyway, let me see. Iron Sheik defeats Ivan Putski by pinfall at 3:50. Steve, this result screams volumes, and I'll explain why. I actually looked this up. Ivan Putski had been wrestling at Madison Square Garden. He's been in and out of the WWF since 1974. This was the first time he had ever been pinned at Madison Square Garden.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And let me go over some of the guys he wrestled. Stan Hansen, Ivan Koloff, Bruiser Brody. Superstar Billy Graham, when he was WWF champion, did not even get a pinfall over Ivan Putski. And I can definitely more than make the argument, I can make the statement that there were times when Ivan Putski was the number two guy in the WWF, both when Bruno was champion and Backlund was champion. And it looks like that is coming to an end, as they're, you know, certainly he's nowhere near number two anymore, and he's doing jobs.
Unlike Backlund, I think Putski's phasing out was a lot more easier to observe and watch. I mean, I would say in a few months he would be gone, but I remember he came back for a brief time in '85. He even wrestled at the Wrestling Classic tournament, to one of their first official pay per view. He wrestled periodically in '86 a little bit. He came back in '87, teamed with Billy Graham on a TV match, and then after that, I don't think we really saw him again until he teamed up with his son, Scott Putski, I think, on a Monday Night Raw show many, many years later. But it was nice to see him just pop in every now and then and still get a pop just for nostalgia, if nothing else. But with Backlund, it was just sad to see him just kind of fade into oblivion, where at least with Putski, he did some jobs on his way out and kind of fulfilled his destiny.
Well, I mean, you know, this is what the podcast is about. The times are changing in the WWF. I mean, Pat Patterson and Chief J. Strongbow are, you know, having a pretty kind of a sad farewell in 1984. And Ivan Putski, you know, once again, you can only push so many guys as the top guy. And Ivan Putski, you know, it looks like the sun is setting on that.
Yeah, and that was good, because all three of the guys you mentioned, Patterson with his gut, and Putski with his receding hairline, and Strongbow with his receding hairline and his gut. I mean, these were all guys that were really over the hill. And the WWF at this time, brilliant marketing, they were pushing the youngest, best-looking guys. Guys like Orndorff and Hogan, and you know, the top echelon of talent that they're grabbing from all the best promotions. So it's like, you know, who better to do jobs than the old guard of wrestlers who've been there for a long time, and now they're making stars out of the guys that they're doing the jobs for.
I have heard over the years that Ivan Putski had kind of an ego. Like, I mean, wrestlers have them, but like on the wrestler scale, supposedly he had a bit of an ego, and this must have been a little bit, I don't know. He must not have been happy having to do a pinfall job for the Sheik in less than 4 minutes. But at the same time, the Sheik needs a win because he's going to be main eventing against Sergeant Slaughter soon. Next match. Roddy Piper and Dr. D. David Schultz defeat Andre the Giant and Jimmy Snuka. Andre got his head busted open. He comes back with a bandage around his head, and somehow he's disqualified because Andre's actions were considered outside interference.
This was kind of a historic match. I mean, it was one of those rare matches where you see Andre really not do a job, but you see Andre really vulnerable and really he goes way, you know, above and beyond to make his opponents look great. And I do recall reading that he was friendly with Piper and was happy to do the job for Piper. I don't know how he felt about Schultz. I don't know about that. But I always remember seeing this match in one of the old Coliseum videos. I'm assuming it was the Piper Coliseum video. And Andre coming out of the dressing room while bandaged up, he kind of looked like Quasimodo entering the ring and attacking Schultz and Piper. And there was a famous match in Boston, since we've talked a lot about Boston on the show today. There was a famous match, and this goes all the way back to July 6, 1968. It was a six-man match where it was, on the heel side, Virgil the Kentucky Butcher, Gorilla Monsoon, and Professor Two Tanaka against the team of Bruno Sammartino, who was the champion at the time, Edouard Carpentier, and Victor Rivera. And on that, in this special tag team match, I know it was a 3 out of 5 falls, so I think it might have been, or 2 out of 3 falls, but early in the match, Bruno got hit with a chair, I think from Monsoon, completely knocked out, and he did a stretcher job, a bloody mess, and then he came back later like Quasimodo, taped up like a mummy, and he came out and, you know, kicked ass at that point. But this match was a huge match as far as getting Piper and Schultz over is an important tag team, important stars.
Oh, definitely. I mean, they were getting the Roddy Piper faction over. I mean, you know, you beat the tag team of Andre the Giant and Jimmy Snuka. Good night. I will bet that this is one. I have nothing to back this up with but anecdotes. But I bet this is one of the most watched matches of all time, because I remember 1985, I got my first VCR. It seemed like all of my friends or their families were getting their first VCRs, like right around the same time, spring, summer 1985, they became affordable. In Nashua, two video stores opened up, Video Mart and Video Mat. If you own one of those stores, you got to call the other owner and say, look, we got to have a coin flip. But I remember, you know, wrestling fans were renting these wrestling tapes. I mean, everyone who is a fan had to have rented at some point Rowdy Piper's greatest hits. And, you know, this match was on that videotape. That's my theory. It's one of the most watched matches ever.
Oh, yeah. I can agree with that. It was it's such a unique match. I mean, you could watch 100 Andre matches and not see him bleed or get injured. And here in this match, he does both, and really does a lot to put Piper over as a dangerous character. And the same for Schultz, too.
No, I agree. I mean, how many teams can you say, you know, these are two of the biggest stars in the world teaming up and Piper and Schultz get the win? WWF Tag Team Champions Tony Atlas and Rocky Johnson fight the Wild Samoans to a double disqualification. WWF Intercontinental Champion Tito Santana and Paul Orndorff go to a 20-minute draw. And Bob Backlund and Greg Valentine go to a double countout at 15 minutes. Steve, this show was not televised, but I'm sure it was all recorded. And WWF, please hand this over to Peacock so they can put it on and I can enjoy it.
Besides the match we've discussed, the Tito versus Orndorff match is on YouTube. I did find that, or Daily Motion, one or the other. And it was a good match, like a 2.5-star match. I would mention that this is kind of a trivia question. I'll say that this was the first WWF MSG house show to not have a championship match, going all the way back to the prior card like that was December of 1980, but there's a caveat to that. There were two cards that month in December of 1980. The first one was headlined by Bruno versus Sergeant Slaughter because Backlund was in Japan. There was a card later in the month where Backlund defended against Killer Khan. But unique that there was no title match for that first match of December 1980. And this is the first time in 5 years that they would have a similar situation, or 4 years, that they have a no championship match on the card. And as we said earlier, it would become not the norm, but it would become something much more common, even on these big shows like an MSG house show.
This was the first time that either there wasn't a championship match or Bruno was not wrestling in a singles main event since 1976, when they had Bruno Sammartino and Tony Parisi against Ivan Koloff and superstar Billy Graham in the main event. So,
right.
But here's the thing. I was looking at this card. It's not a bad card, but it's missing that Hulk Hogan match, and yet it still drew over 26,000 fans. It must have been $250,000 gross.
Well, the fans were just so hungry to watch anything WWF related, and most of the big stars are on this card with the exception of Hogan. And I think it should be also worth noting, look at the date of the card, March 25th, 1984. The first WrestleMania would be a year and 6 days away, so which was also a Sunday, well, a matinee show on a Sunday like this one was. I mean, we haven't even gotten close to the hype for WrestleMania 1, but the buzz and the interest in the WWF seems like it's at an all-time high here.
I mean, a couple of things. I mean, Vince McMahon, I've always given him credit for this. A lot of guys would have just sat on the formula. I mean, here he has a promotion that is on fire, and he decides to reinvent the wheel. I mean, to me, that's crazy, but at the same time, it worked. And, you know, Vince had a vision, and he went through with it. Number two, I have always maintained that with very few exceptions, There are people who always say, oh, this guy was a draw, and that guy was a draw, but this person wasn't a draw. I think it's the promotion that is the draw, generally speaking. Yes, Andre the Giant, people who are non-wrestling fans would come out to see wrestling if Andre was in town. Yes, Hulk Hogan was definitely a draw. Dusty Rhodes was a draw. But I think more than anything, I mean, what's Hulk Hogan without the WWF?
No, true. And the WWF brand, which Vince was creating here, and we've talked about it on previous shows, the fact that he's talking about the magazine, the fact that the logo is constantly on the screen, that they have banners in the background that say World Wrestling Federation, this had never been done before. I mean, even in the old days of his father, you could buy programs from the promotion, and the WWF or the Triple WF logo was never in the magazine. I mean, they would talk about Capital Wrestling or something like that, but just reinvented the wheel. I mean, he promoted the promotion itself, the name of the promotion, and these guys are creating, you know, the WWF for all the future generations that followed. I mean, I think Vince wanted to make the WWF the star, and that probably didn't even happen until, at least in my opinion, until maybe the 2000s with the John Cena era. But he created a lot of stars and people that were throwaways, like you know, the Stone Colds and the Mankinds and guys that weren't over as stars. And then he turned them into these legendary icons that people love to this day. So his ability to make WrestleMania and to take the old Northeast promotion and to take it national is just such a great story. I never tire of talking about it.
No, it's really amazing how he rebranded the wrestling. I mean, it used to be, you know, All-Star Wrestling returns to the Boston Garden on December 10th, 1980, and now he's out there, World Wrestling Federation. He's like, you know, really hammering that.
Oh, yeah. And I can remember in my hometown of Binghamton, we had a marquee outside of our arena that would tell you who was coming to the arena, whether it was a hockey game or Ann Murray or Kiss or whoever it was. And in the old days, they'd put up the word wrestling. And as we got into this era and the years that followed, they would just put up the three letters, WWF. And that was all the people needed to know. They knew what to expect. They knew what they were going to get when they arrived. And people loved coming to the matches.
I mean, I agree with you, Steve. And I think what Vince McMahon did to differentiate what he was putting out from the rest of the pro wrestling world, and we'll be talking more about that as this podcast continues. I hope you enjoyed that. It was, you know, Steve and I had a lot to say about a 31 days of the WWF, you know, March of 1984, and I hope you enjoyed it. We're going to do part three of three next week. I want to thank Steve Generelli for everything he did, sitting down and recording with us and doing all the research he did. I want to thank Brian Last for giving us this forum. I want to thank Lou Kippelman for all the great work he does producing this podcast and just being a great guy and being flexible with his schedule. And most importantly, of course, I want to thank you, the listener, for being part of Stick to Wrestling. And with that, we'll see you next week. This has been a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network.
This concludes our podcast day.